thanks for the introduction. And thanks to everyone for coming. This is partly just an opportunity for me to introduce myself, because as Moritz said, I just moved to CETA down the road, and I'll probably be hanging around here every so often. So if I haven't met you before, feel free to come up after and introduce yourself. I'm here all day today and tomorrow. I'm going to be talking today about how to use cosmic shear as a probe of the physics of galaxy formation. And I realize that this is a cosmology seminar, and I think of myself as someone who's interested more in cosmology than in the physics of galaxy formation. So I'll start with some motivation for why, as a cosmologist, you might still be interested in the processes that are going into forming galaxies and moving baryons around in the universe. So when we think of where cosmology and large-scale structure is in the current day towards the end of 2016, we're basically on the brink of receiving a tremendous amount of new observational inputs about the large-scale structure of the universe. And these inputs will come in several different forms. They'll come in the positions and measurements of the shapes, the observed shapes of millions of galaxies. They'll come through information about large-scale structure from the absorption, spectra of different quasars through the so-called Lyman Alpha Forest. They'll come from intensity maps of various molecular transitions measured by instruments such as CHIME in Canada, and other probes that that we could talk about. But either way, we're going to get all this tremendous amount of data, and through a process of modeling and making predictions from theories, there's a tremendous opportunity for us to learn a lot about both old physics and new physics, where old physics I'm calling physics which is more familiar from the standard models of particle physics and cosmology, and also new physics, things which we maybe don't know that much about in terms of observational inputs. So things like non-Gaussianity from inflation or from the early universe, the existence of possible new light particle species, which we haven't seen before, possible time evolution of the dark energy equation of state, or possible deviations from general relativity, which you could parameterize, for example, through this gamma index in the growth rate of structures. But of course, making the connection between all this data and all these things which we'd like to learn about depends on having a robust pipeline for making predictions from these theories and propagating them through to the observations that we'll see. So in large-scale structure, one common thing that we would like to measure and also like to make predictions for is the matter power spectrum. So just recall quickly, if we measure the density of matter in the universe, we can define the deviations from the background density as this over-density delta. And then if we Fourier transform delta and take the autocorrelations of the Fourier modes, this is the matter power spectrum, which basically is measuring the clustering of matter on different scales. If we'd like to measure this from an observation of the delta field, we Fourier transform it, we divide the Fourier space up into thin shells based on the magnitude of the wave number, we average this autocorrelation in these shells, and we divide by the volume of each shell. And this gives you an estimator for P of K from some data set which you're using to infer the overdensity field. On a log-log plot, the power spectrum looks like this, probably kind of familiar. So there are a few different regimes on this plot. At the regime of large distances or low wave numbers, the evolution of the large-scale structure is very linear, so we can use the linear theory predictions, which are very well understood and available to everyone through public codes. In the opposite regime, you have nonlinear corrections from gravity, which are swamping the predictions of linear theory, and so for these, you need to use either n-body simulations or phenomenological models, such as halo models. There's a regime in between where the nonlinear corrections are growing large, but are still small enough that you can hope to treat them as perturbations to the linear theory predictions. And this is something which I spent a lot of time thinking about during my PhD and new ways to perform these perturbations. So if you're interested in this, then you can come and talk to me some other time. But either way, that's just a summary of the regimes here. And all of these regimes I'm considering are only just from gravitational nonlinearities. But even if you have a very nice handle on these nonlinear corrections, there are still other things which you need to take care of before you can make this propagation from the theory through to the measurements. One of these is the effects of the physics of baryons in the universe. So on this plot, I've taken the matter power spectrum measured from a simulation with dark matter and various prescriptions for baryonic physics, such as the cooling of gas and the forming of stars in the universe. I've taken the ratio of this power spectrum to one measured from an equivalent simulation with only gravitational nonlinearities, no baryonic effects. So at large scales, or low wave numbers, the baryons don't affect the clustering very much, but as you move to smaller and smaller scales, you begin to see this characteristic suppression. The main thing that causes this suppression is so-called feedback processes operating within dark matter halos. What these feedback processes are doing is they're injecting energy into the gas, which is cooling at the center of these dark matter halos, and expelling it outwards, and thereby smoothing the matter field on these kind of scales, and therefore decreasing the clustering. So a cartoon of the motivation for why these feedback processes are implemented in simulations is that stars form when gas cools enough to become dense, And if you perform a simulation without any of these kind of feedback mechanisms, you find that the gas is cooling and stars are forming much more efficiently than stars are actually observed in the universe. So you need to add some kind of prescription to prevent the gas from cooling so efficiently to suppress the star formation down to observed levels. And one promising solution to this approach, which has come out in recent years, is feedback, particularly from active galactic nuclei, whereas a very massive black hole is accreting mass, somehow it's pumping energy back into the surrounding gas, which acts to heat it up and then push it out and suppress the star formation in this way. So this is the effect it has on star formation, but it also tends to affect the matter power spectrum in this way. Another effect, which looks rather similar, is the effect of massive neutrinos. So neutrinos tend to free stream out of potential wells where they would otherwise cluster. They don't cluster as strongly as just dark matter or other kinds of baryons. So then if some fraction of the mass of matter in the universe is made up of these massive neutrinos, this also tends to suppress the power and suppress the clustering. And there's a certain range of scales where these effects look very degenerate. So if, for instance, you are interested in measuring the neutrino mass by looking at the matter power spectrum, you need to make sure that you have a good handling on the modeling of these feedback effects, or else you could become confused between the two. So given this, it's reasonable to ask how much uncertainty we currently have in the modeling of these feedback effects. And the answer is not too optimistic at this stage. So now I've plotted the same thing as the previous plot, ratio of simulations with baryons to simulations with only dark matter, for a selection of three current sophisticated hydrodynamical simulations which purport to include both the effects of gravity and these various feedback and gas cooling effects. And we find very different predictions for what they say about the suppression of clustering in the total distribution of matter. Now, this isn't some unknown crisis that I discovered on my own just by making this plot. This is just an indication that the field of hydrodynamical simulations is still evolving. No one would claim that each of these simulations are perfect, but there's definitely more work to be done in trying to improve the realism of these simulations and matching to various observations. Yes?
When you look at the transfer function, which is the power,
right?
Baryon plus compound.
Right.
Baryon has oscillations.
Right.
So you have to use a wave function if you analyze the data. So what about that structure, the baryon oscillation structure? How does that affect?
So I would say that these are all effects which are coming in at early enough times that these kind of feedback effects aren't. So these effects, if you do, for example, the gravity-only simulation and then the dark matter-only simulation, these baryon transfer effects that you're discussing will be included in both simulations, just in the initial conditions of the nonlinear structure formation. They're not ignored, but they're not affected by these feedback processes just because they're in different regimes.
It's later,
yeah.
So over one order of magnitude, one doesn't even know if it's a suppression or if it goes up, the blue line compared to the green.
Yeah, basically, based on the way that the feedback is implemented in these different simulations, there's really this amount of uncertainty. And so on the next slide, I just give a glimpse of some of the details about why this might be the case. So each of these three simulations, they use a different prescription for how black holes are depositing energy back into the surrounding gas. And each of these prescriptions have free parameters which are tuned to different sets of observations. So in OWL's AGN, they tune their model to low redshift observations of the population of black holes, such as the overall density, and as well as to minimize numerical effects, which they realize might creep up in their simulations. For massive black, this relation is tuned to the normalization of the observed M sigma relation for black holes. And illustrious, they try to do a bit more detailed modeling in that they include two different modes of feedback depending on the accretion rate of each black hole. And the free parameters in these relations are tuned to match the stellar mass halo mass relation from abundance matching, which is a way to do simulations where you populate dark matter halos with galaxies and then measure the resulting properties of the galaxy population. And as you can see, the detailed way in which the feedback is implemented, even disregarding the parameters, is very different. This is because at the current level of computational sophistication of these simulations, they're not sufficient, or the resolution is not sufficient to resolve these detailed feedback processes from first principles. So they need to put in some so-called subgrid model, just some physical prescription on top of the basic hydrodynamics in order to realize these processes.
So is every galaxy is an AGN simulation?
So the way it works is that when a dark matter halo goes above a certain mass, then it's populated with a black hole of a certain mass given by a certain distribution. And then when this black hole becomes massive enough, then these feedback processes kick in the simulation.
They're all converting accretion rate into heat. And so it seems quite surprising that the sign of the effect is even different than in the previous plot.
Yeah. Yeah, so you would, you know, it's surprising to me as well, especially because these two, you know, they're basically, yeah, they're all depending on accretion mass or accretion rate. And so, you know, I don't really have a good explanation. I can say more about why I would suspect that these will be different, or Lespris will be different from these two. But in terms of these two, it's still kind of a mystery to me, obviously, as well. But anyway, that's just to say that these collaborations all decide to use different prescriptions and tune them to different observations. And the end result is that we get something like this. So it would be nice to have more observational inputs that these groups can use to tune their simulations to try and make them more realistic.
Just a quick question. Yes. By way of more background, because I don't know much about it.
Sure.
There's an argument that the supernova feedback and stuff like that is subdominant to this black hole stuff, or what's the order of importance of all the different kinds of things that are going on?
So it's generally true that the supernova feedback is subdominant based on the way people try to tune their models and measure the different effects. I'll show a plot later which has simulations with and without supernova and AGN feedback that you can compare. But people generally think that the AGN feedback is the strongest. Okay, so given this uncertainty in the modeling, one question that you could ask is how do current analyses of cosmological data handle this uncertainty if it might be important for inferences from the data that they're collecting. And so the example that I'm focused on in this talk is cosmic shear, and the standard approach from current measurements of cosmic shear is to simply ignore the data points where these uncertainties in the modeling might be important. So this is a plot of measurements from the Dark Energy Survey first data release, the science verification, the cosmic shear two-point functions measured as a function of angular scale in the sky. And these shaded regions are regions where the data points are removed from the cosmological analysis. The motivation for this is that the prediction between the dark matter power spectrum, or the difference between the dark matter power spectrum and the power spectrum from one of these simulations is more than 5%, or it gives you more than a 5% difference in the modeling of the shear correlation functions on these scales. And the authors determine that this is large enough to significantly bias the constraints on cosmology. So they simply remove these points from their analysis. And this ends up being about half of the points that they collect, actually, which is clearly not an ideal simulation, or not an ideal situation. We would like to be able to use these scales to learn something about the universe. And even if it's difficult currently to use these scales to learn about cosmology, what I'd like to do in this talk is flip the question around and say, instead of throwing away these points because we can't use them for cosmology, can we keep these points and do a separate analysis to see if we can learn about the effects of baryons on these scales? So instead of treating the baryonic effects as nuisance to be marginalized over, treating this as signal to be constrained using these measurements.
So the solid lines, which are presumably some theory of prediction, just the cosmology part of it, should you be surprised that a lot of the discarded data points seem like they fit pretty well? Does that tell you something about how important the baryonic effects are?
I don't think you should be super surprised because of For one, some of the error bars on these points are quite large, and the errors between these points are also kind of correlated. So it's tough to do a chi by I to assess the range of the effects. And in general, a big shift in this curve will have a very large effect on the cosmological parameters. So you're looking at tiny shifts in these curves, which translate into meaningful effects in the cosmological parameters. So in this sense, it's more the deviations between these dotted red lines, which are the hydro predictions, and the solid, which are the dark matter only, which are actually important for what they're measuring.
Oh, I see. So that's what they think the variance
is. Yeah, this is just how they estimate the size of the effects and where they might be dangerous for their analysis.
So how you guarantee, it seems like the difference between those curves is way smaller than their errors.
It is, so it's way smaller than their error bars, but I guess when you propagate through to the analysis and you include the other systematics which are involved in these measurements, then it turns out to be it can be an effect that they want to be conservative and just neglect in their analysis. Yeah. So that's the overall picture of what I'm going to talk about. From here, I'll start out with a brief review of cosmic shear in general. So I figured this might be a mixed audience. I'll talk about general properties of these measurements and how these measurements are affected by the clustering of matter. I'll talk about a convenient parameterization we found for the matter power spectrum on scales where feedback is important, based on a model-independent principal component analysis approach. I'll talk about the details and some forecasts we did for how much signal you can extract from stage 3 and stage 4 surveys using this approach. And then I'll show you the results of these forecasts. So just to start, cosmic shear is a kind of gravitational lensing, which is probably a familiar concept to everyone. In general, light rays do not travel on completely straight Euclidean paths through the universe. They instead travel on geodesics, which are bent by the distribution of matter along the line of sight. This image is an image of the strong lensing regime, where light rays are bent so strongly that you might actually think a galaxy is in a completely different point on the sky. And indeed, you might see different images of the same galaxies because the light rays are bent, and then they come at us from different directions, even though they came from the same object. But cosmic shear is in the opposite regime, the regime of weak lensing, where instead of things being moved around large distances on the sky, instead it's only the shapes of galaxies that we measure, which are distorted by on average 1% compared to their intrinsic shape. So this is a very small signal if you look at a single galaxy. You need a large number of galaxies in order to extract this signal. These distortions will also be correlated because the distortions in the shapes all depend on the same matter along the line of sight. So just a brief cartoon of how the formalism works. If we consider a galaxy located at co-moving distance chi from our observers and some reference angle beta, or at an angle beta away from some reference angle, in the flat sky approximation, beta is just a two-dimensional vector on the flat sky which we view. Now, because of gravitational lensing, we will in general think that the galaxy is located at some other position given by this angle theta instead of beta. So this picture is usually exaggerated because we're talking about shape distortions, not position distortions. So in general, it'll just be points on our image of the galaxy which are distorted by this, but this is a clear illustration. Now, if we think about the mapping between the observed angle theta and the true angle beta, we can write it as this distortion matrix, which we can in turn write as just some derivatives of this scalar quantity, the lensing potential, which in turn is just written as a line of sight integral of the Newtonian potential between us and the source galaxy, weighted by some geometric factor. And the fact that you can write it like this depends on various approximations, which are all based on the fact that we're in the regime of weak lensing, where the deflections are very small. We can further take this distortion matrix and decompose it into a trace and a trace-free part. The trace isotropic part, we can use that to define the convergence, which is just the isotropic magnification or demagnification of an image caused by gravitational lensing. The trace-free part, we can decompose into two components of the shear, which tells you about the anisotropic distortion or rotation or stretching of an image. Now, just by inspection, comparing these two expressions for the distortion matrix, we can further relate the convergence field kappa and the two components of the shear field gamma to the lensing potential. And then by Fourier transforming, we can further attain that the shear field in Fourier space is just related to the convergence field by a phase, which means that the two-point correlations of the shear field are equal to the two-point correlations of the convergence field. This is important because the shear field is easier to measure, but the convergence field is easier to model. The reason this is easier to measure is that the orientations of galaxies on the sky, on average, are randomly distributed. So if we see any correlations in these orientations, then we're really going to get, we're really just measuring the shear field, modulo a subtlety, which I'll come back to. To do the same exercise for the convergence field, we would need the background distribution of sizes of galaxies of various types, which is much tougher to pin down observationally. So it's much more common to use observations of the shear than observations of the convergence, although people are working on this and gradually making some headway. Also, you can use CMB lensing to estimate the convergence field, but that's kind of a separate analysis. So moving to the convergence field and thinking about how to model it, just the overall picture to have in mind is that the convergence depends on a line of sight projection of the overdensity field, again, times some geometric factor, which you can derive. And you can further compress this 3D convergence field into a two-dimensional average over a redshift bin with a distribution of sources given by Ni. The reason you need to do this is because, like I said, to get nice measurements of the shear field, you need a large number of galaxies, which means you need a photometric redshift survey, which has fairly poor accuracy in the redshift direction. So in order to get enough statistical significance and beat down these uncertainties in the photometric redshifts, you need to average the convergence or average the shear field over a broad redshift bin, which looks something like this in the case of dark energy survey. So we find that these redshift bins each have fairly broad distributions of the redshifts of the objects within them. And if you try and push this too much smaller, then you risk being overcome by the uncertainties in the redshifts of the individual objects. So just finally, a brief thing about how shear is measured. For each galaxy, you can define some reference angles and measure the ellipticity along the gamma 1 and gamma 2 directions, so like the horizontal direction and then some cross direction. But if you're doing correlations, it's more convenient to take each pair of galaxies that you're considering and redefine the axes so that you have the shear along a direction just along the vector connecting the two galaxies and then the cross direction. So this is analogous to a kind of EB decomposition based on helicity of the shears. From this, we finally define the shear correlation functions, C plus minus, as linear combinations of the tangential-tangential correlation or the cross-cross correlation. The TX correlation vanishes by parity. So to measure these, we take all of the pairs of galaxies, we bin them into their angular separation, we measure the shapes and form these components, and then we multiply them by weights based on how well we think we've measured the shapes of each galaxy. And then we average this in each bin to get an estimator for the shear signal within this bin. To calculate these from theory, you can derive that these psi plus minus are just Hankel transforms over the angular power spectrum of the convergence, which in turn depends on a line of sight integral over the power spectrum of the density field, again, times some geometric factor, which you can derive. So all of this is just to say that the shear is something that we can measure in a well-defined way, and its connection to the matter power spectrum, which are the underlying clustering of matter, is also well-defined through these relationships. So given these connections, if we would like to use shear to learn something about the matter power spectrum, we should have some nice parameterization of the power spectrum in hand that we can use. The simplest one maybe that you could think of is to take the values of the measured power spectrum you expect to measure, divide them by corresponding predictions from some dark matter-only model of clustering, and then simply make your model be one defined by parameters that are just the values of this function on a grid in wave number and redshift. So immediately we find that this model has a number of disadvantages. First, there are very large degeneracies between all these parameters, because since the shear is defined as a projection of the matter power spectrum along various lines of sight, you'll get trajectories in this plane along which the points are strongly degenerate. And second, the constraints on each of these points will vary widely. For a given lensing survey, its sensitivity peaks at some localized region in this plane. For dark energy survey, this is around redshift of a few, wave number of a few inverse megaparsecs and redshift of a half. So these points will be most strongly correlated or most strongly constrained. These points will be very unconstrained. so unconstrained that we might as well not even include them in an analysis. So we'd like to find some way to try and compress the information down to a smaller number of parameters, which is more meaningful for us. The way that we do this, or the way that we found to do this in a nice fashion, is through a sort of principal component analysis, which goes like the following. For a given survey, we estimate the properties, the binning schemes, and so forth, of the data that we expect to collect from that survey. From this, we can calculate a Fisher matrix, where the parameters of the model in the Fisher matrix are these power spectrum values on the grid that I just described, plus cosmology and systematics parameters that you'd like to vary. Once you have this Fisher matrix, you invert it to get an approximate covariance matrix for all these parameters. And then you diagonalize the submatrix of the covariance matrix corresponding to just these power spectrum values that you care about. So what this procedure gives you is a set of eigenvectors, which are linear combinations of the power spectrum values, which are maximally uncorrelated in a given set of measurements by design. Along with these linear combinations, you get a set of eigenvalues, which are the expected variances of the amplitudes of each one of these linear combinations if you were to try and take that linear combination and measure it as a parameter from your data. So now you have a new basis of parameters, one which is automatically ranked in terms of how relevant each parameter is for a given survey. From this, you can identify the linear combinations which are fairly irrelevant for a given survey and simply throw them away because they won't be well constrained anyway, and then keep a small number of these linear combinations in this list and try and constrain these. So if you plot these linear combinations with the weighting of each point in the grid on the z-axis given by the color, and then the wave number redshift plane along the x and y-axis, they look something like this, for the example of the dark energy survey again. So you find these localized splotches, and the principal component procedure tells you that the overall amplitude of each one of these splotches are the things that are going to be the best constrained by the dark energy survey. And then there are other combinations of these points which will be much worse constrained. So again, the idea is to keep only a few of these principal components in a likelihood analysis, constrain their amplitudes, and then after that, we can take a set of baryonic models that we're interested in, map their power spectrum predictions onto these principal components, and then compare the constraints on the principal components to the predictions of various models. So this PCA procedure is model independent. It only depends on the properties of the observations. So we define these variables, we constrain them, and then afterwards we take the simulations and map them on and do the comparison as a second step. So the first question you could ask, putting what I said into words a bit more into numbers, is how steeply the constraints on each of these principal components drop off as you move up this list of eigenvalues. So this is what I show on this plot. This is the index of a certain principal component in the list. On the y-axis is the expected 1 sigma constraint on the amplitude of that principal component, normalized to the expected constraint on the one that you expect to be best constrained. So this shows you how steeply the constraints are dropping off. And these two lines are for two different samplings of the wave number redshift plane. There's a fairly fine sampling, and there's a fairly coarse sampling for which the constraints drop off a lot more steeply. This is because when you're sampling this plane more coarsely, you're effectively binning the signal in the power spectrum in a certain region of wave number redshift more strongly into a single point. So then the strongest constrained linear combinations of these coarsely sampled points will in general be better constrained corresponding to the other linear combinations compared to the fine sampling. So for the rest of this year work, we choose a fairly coarse sampling of this wave number redshift plane and just use principal components defined from that.
So is the coarseness in redshift determined by the binning that DES does?
The coarseness, so the range of redshifts that we consider for the grid is determined by the range of redshifts that DES has. The coarseness is more determined just by this kind of procedure, where you want to sample fairly coarsely so that you only need a small number of principal components, but you don't want to sample so coarsely that you only have a few samples, and then interpolating between these samples to form the model is kind of difficult. So there's a trade-off, and we found the 5x5 sampling was a reasonable compromise on both of those.
But given the big width of the redshift, is that you're lumping things in? I mean, that must give you some instruction into actually determining what the power spectrum is to give a dimension, right?
You can definitely use that, and the coarseness of the sampling means that we have maybe a few samples in each of these bins, also because the bins overlap a bit as well. So I suppose you could use this as another minimum bound on the sampling, where you don't want it to be so coarse that you're missing some bins completely. And you could also consider whether to sample in linearly or log, and I mean this kind of thing. So you're right that this is an important consideration for a given survey. And so once you've decided on the sampling, the next question you could ask is, if you actually have a set of simulations that you care about, how many of these principal components that you need do you need to keep to make sure you're obtaining reasonable constraints on those simulations themselves? So to do this, we selected a test set of simulations, the so-called OWLS set of simulations, which have 9 different prescriptions for what baryons are doing to the dark matter, to the overall matter in the universe. For each simulation, we define the following simple parameterization, just based on a single parameter A bar, which interpolates between the dark matter only power spectrum prediction and the one from the simulation. So A bar equals 0 corresponds to dark matter only. A bar equals 1 corresponds to the exact prediction from the simulation. A bar in between 0 and 1 corresponds to something somewhere in between. So by keeping the first n principal components in the list for a given survey, forecasting how well we can constrain those, we can then map these onto effective constraints onto this A bar parameter for each simulation and see how well we can actually narrow down, or how well we can distinguish this simulation from the dark matter only case. So on the x-axis of each of these plots for 2 different surveys, this is the number of principal components that we keep in the list from that survey. On the y-axis, it's effectively the fraction of constraining power of the total number of principal components contained in the first n. So we can see, as you keep more and more, you're approaching 1. So eventually, you completely saturate the constraints that you get from all principal components. And what we did was just drew a threshold at 90%, somewhat arbitrarily, and said, we would like to keep a number of principal components such that we're attaining 90% of the constraining power. The solid lines in these curves are corresponding to if we want to constrain the OWLS AGN model, which is the most realistic model from this test set. The blue shading corresponds to the range over all the models that we considered. And so we find that over both these surveys and over all these models, the magic number is 9 principal components. If we keep at least 9 of these in all the surveys that we consider, then we're retaining at least 90% of the constraining power of the full data set. This is something that could be tuned for an individual survey. Even from this, you can see that for DES, you need probably no more than 7. But for the purpose of making forecasts, which are uniform over all these different surveys, we just picked 9 principal components and went with that for the forecasts. So this was the parameterization we chose, basically using principal component analysis to isolate localized deviations from the dark matter-only power spectrum in terms of linear combinations of these values. And I argued that there's a small number of these principal components that you can use to capture the majority of the constraining power of a given survey if you care about these effects. So we went on to make some more detailed forecasts for how you could do for this with cosmic shear from different surveys. So we considered 6 different surveys, including one which has actually already happened, but we wanted to use it as a point of comparison for our currently available data. And these values were drawn either from publications by these groups or from communications with members of these groups to try and pin down reasonable properties that they expect for the shear measurements. For each of these, we assume 6 log-spaced angular bins for the shear correlation functions. We also assume the best met cosmology from Planck 2015. And in the forecast, we marginalize over the Planck 1 sigma constraints on this cosmology. So this is actually an important point. If you left the cosmology completely free and you tried to do a joint constraint between this and the baryonic effects, there would be significant degeneracies. So in this analysis, it's important to assume that we basically already know the background cosmology and we fix it to what we think it is and just let the small scales of the matter power spectrum vary and try and constrain those on their own. I also showed you at the beginning that neutrino mass can be fairly degenerate with the effects we want to try and get at. And since in this work we only care about feedback and related things, we completely marginalize over neutrino mass. If you don't do this, then you get constraints which are around a factor of two weaker, just because of the degeneracies with that effect on the power spectrum. So there are many other, or there are many systematics which can come into cosmic shear measurements. And we took pains to try and enumerate all of these and marginalize over them with reasonable prescriptions. So there are possible biases that come in from the shear calibration, that is just from the measurements of the shapes of galaxies of different types. There are also uncertainties possible from the photometric redshifts that are used for the objects. For both of these, we adapt the procedure that was used in this dark energy survey science verification analysis. So we assume a single multiplicative bias per tomographic redshift bin, and we assume a single translation of the total redshift distribution in each bin, and we marginalize over these with a prior 5%, which is the same as what DES used. There's also the problem of intrinsic alignments, which uncovers one of the flaws in what I said before, in that the distribution of galaxy shapes is not, in general, completely random. Galaxies will be aligned with tidal fields nearby at the times that they're formed or at the times that their shapes are set. And so you need to model this effect because it also affects the power spectrum. For this, we again adapt what the dark energy survey did in choosing a single model, the nonlinear alignment model, which bases these alignments on the nonlinear matter power spectrum at the times that galaxies are formed. We assign this a single free amplitude, and we marginalize over this with a very wide prior. There's also uncertainty in modeling of the dark matter only nonlinearities themselves, and we allow for two different uncertainties in two different wave number ranges based on currently available simulations or fitting functions for these. And we marginalize over two separate amplitudes for this uncertainty with priors given there. And there's one other class of effects that we still need to marginalize over, other so-called theoretical systematics that could come in your modeling of the shear signal. So two of these, which end up having a very similar form, are the reduced shear correction and the lensing bias. The reduced shear correction is the fact that when you measure these shapes with the estimator I talked about earlier, you actually don't measure the shear field itself, you measure gamma over 1 minus kappa, because the galaxies have also been magnified or demagnified. In the weak lensing regime, this fraction should be very close to gamma, but if you expand the denominator, then you do get higher correlations between the gamma and the kappa fields and so on, and you need to take these into account if you're dealing with stage 4 surveys in particular, where they could become sizable at the level of the measurements you're doing. There's also this lensing bias, which is an umbrella term for the fact that, for example, if a galaxy is magnified, its flux is also magnified. So if you have a magnitude-limited sample, some galaxies that would have been just below the cut can actually be scattered above the cut by lensing, and this can further bias your measurements of the shear. So there are published calculations of how these effects might look or the effects they might have on the convergence power spectrum. But at the level of the forecasts we're doing, we found that there's a fairly simple model that could capture both of these shapes, which is just L to the 1/2 times some free amplitude. And at the level of detail of the forecast we're doing, we found that the simple model actually captures these published shapes of the detailed calculations quite well. So we just take this amplitude and we marginalize over a prior 5%, which is what people estimate the rough size of these effects will be for stage 3 and stage 4 surveys. So there's the census of all the things we marginalize over. We consider a wide range of survey properties for these 6 surveys. And we did our best to pick every other contaminant that could bias our inference about these effects, and we try and marginalize over it in some reasonable way. So for the results of the forecast we did, there are two main components of those results. The first one was that we tried to do something model independent in defining a kind of figure of merit, just comparing how well each of these surveys could do intrinsically without actually picking specific test models. To do this, we define this figure of merit, which is the inverse of the geometric mean of the expected 1 sigma constraints on the amplitudes of the first 9 principal components. This is basically the average constraint on all of these linear combinations, which you can translate into the average constraint on some test set of baryonic models. So on the x-axis are the 6 surveys we considered. On the y-axis is our estimation of this figure of merit, normalized to the one from the published DES data, just to tell you the factor of improvement that each of these surveys will obtain over DES science verification. And the takeaway here is that we find that these stage three near-term surveys like DES year five and Hyper Supreme Chem will obtain roughly an order of magnitude improvement in this figure of merit. These stage four surveys will obtain roughly a factor of a few on top of that. If you ask what drives this, you can look at the different properties of these surveys, and it's mainly just the number of galaxies which have well-measured shapes. So the sky fraction times the density of sources on the sky to some power, which I haven't included here, but it's not exactly a linear dependence. So the upshot here is that our biggest gain in our knowledge of feedback effects from cosmic shear will just come from data sets which will actually be analyzed in the near term. And then these more ambitious surveys will teach us many other things, but in terms of this, they'll only act as a refinement of what we already learned in the near term. Yeah?
If you're able to get survey data from some magical survey that have much deeper redshifts, do you think that would improve the figure of merit quite a bit?
I don't think it would improve it that much, just because most of the strength of these effects, so most of, from what, let's see, from the forecast we did, we found that most of the constraining power is actually coming from very small distance scales where cooling is active. And this is only happening at kind of later redshifts. So this higher redshift information, I don't think it would help that much for these effects, unless it helped to break degeneracies between other parameters we're varying. And so the second component is the actual forecast we made for a specific test set of models. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of colors on this plot. But so on the x-axis, these are the names of the nine test sets, or the names of the nine baryonic models that we considered in our test set. Again, AGN is the most realistic one because it tries to include a nice prescription for AGN feedback. On the y-axis, we display the results of the exercise where we assume that the dark matter-only power spectrum is the true model, and we say, at what statistical significance in terms of number of sigmas could we rule out the predictions from each of these simulations if we assume the dark matter only model is correct and we apply this parameterization that we came up with? And under this assumption of angular scales, where the 2 arc minute minimum scale is a rather standard minimum scale down to which you can measure these correlation functions reliably. But I'll come back to this assumption in a second. But first, from this plot, we find that currently available data can't really do that much. The rest of this curve is much below the 1 sigma marker. As you move up to the stage 3, the DES and Hyper Supreme Chem, you start to get some interesting constraints on various members of this test set. And then as you move up to stage 4, you find that most of the models are above 5 sigma here, meaning that you can get much stronger tests on the reliability of these models just from this futuristic data, which is farther down the line. So this is great. It shows that eventually, with realistic surveys, this technique can have some power. What's perhaps more interesting is if you relax this assumption of the minimum scale at which you can measure the correlation functions. So people who do these measurements claim that the systematics on these small scales will eventually get more and more well controlled. So you'll actually be able to push slightly farther with measurements of these correlation functions. So suppose you decrease this minimum scale by a factor of 4 down to half an arc minute. What you find in this case is that, again, currently available data can't do much, except perhaps for this no supernova model. But if you look at the stage 3 surveys, now they've jumped way, way up on this plot to the point where most of the models in this test set we expect can be ruled out at better than 5 sigma. Again, given the assumption we made where we assume that the dark matter only model is correct. So this represents another strong motivation for these teams to actually control their systematics at these small scales. Because given this in data that's coming out in only a few years, we could actually obtain very strong constraints on the realism of these simulations through a kind of observational window which has never been opened before. and so one notable feature of this plot is the fact that the constraints on some of these models are much better than others. And to think about why that is, we can go back to a plot similar to the one I showed for the introduction. But now these are the curves corresponding to each of these 9 models that I showed you before. So these are from the OWL set. The AGN one is the long dashed line showing here, which includes this AGN feedback. None of these other simulations include AGN feedback. So these ones all include supernova feedback with various prescriptions to try and boost it, such as using strong winds from the supernova. And some of these simulations are already more unrealistic because they don't include any supernova feedback, which we know to exist in the real universe. So a good example is this no SN, no supernova curve shown in the dot dashed lines, which has none of these feedback effects. So at large scales, there's basically no difference from the dark matter only comparison. At small scales, there are very strong effects. And these are coming mainly from the cooling of gas inside dark matter halos, which can strongly enhance the density contrast on these scales compared to the dark matter only prediction. So you get a really strong deviation from the dark matter only prediction on these scales. The feedback also has some effect on these scales. So in models like AGN, where you have both of these effects, you have a competition here, which is reducing the discrepancy between the dark matter and the hydrodynamical simulation predictions on these scales. So now if you go back to what I showed before, and you consider that we're going down to very small scales here, this no supernova model, for example, has this very strong deviations, the strongest of any model in the test set at these small scales. And the fact that we went down to these small scales means that a lot of the constraining power on these models is actually coming from this extra bit of correlation function information that we had, which means that the models which have the strongest cooling and the weakest feedback on these small scales are actually the best constrained. If you move back again to the more conservative assumption, you see that this isn't so much the case. Now that we've cut out these small range of scales where the cooling is strongest, we found that models which have strong effects at large scales and small scales are constrained on more equal footing. And one final point to mention is that there are data sets from Dark Energy Survey which will happen sooner than year 5, which is maybe 4 years away. So I didn't plot these curves, but there is a Dark Energy Survey year 1 data set, which will be, as you would expect, somewhere between the science verification and the year 5 curve. So even from this data set, which will be finished and analyzed on the matter of months, there is a chance to begin to get interesting constraints on some of these models. Yeah.
What is NOZ cool?
So NOZ cool. So it includes no supernovae, and it also doesn't include metal line cooling of the gas, I think. So it has weaker cooling than the other models, which do include this. So anyway, there's this year one curve, which you can picture being somewhere along here. And this indicates that perhaps it would be even useful to try and apply this this method to the year one measurements. And there is a project ongoing within Dark Energy Survey, which I'm involved in, to actually do this for the year one shear measurements and try and obtain constraints, not only on this model of tests or this test set of models, but also on some of these more sophisticated models that I showed earlier. So we're slowly collecting power spectrum measurements from various members of these teams so that we have a library that we can use to compare to these constraints once we actually have the data in hand. So this principal component analysis thing can't, or it doesn't have to only be used for simulations. You can also take the constraints on these PCs and map them onto constraints of other models which actually have parameters with physical meanings, such as a modified halo model or a model which parameterizes gas profiles and dark matter profiles in some way. So this is also another avenue. And this overall PCA method, it's certainly one that we didn't come up with. It's just one that we applied to this problem. But it could also be applied to other problems. So one example that I can think of is a common parameterization of modified gravity, where you parameterize the G potentials in the Newtonian gauge metric just in terms of some free functions of wave number and redshift. But in the absence of any prior on what you think those functions might be, you could just say, what are the components or what are the principal components of those functions which can be best parameterized by a given survey, and then just get information on those. This might be another model independent way to make some headway in this problem. So that's all the main content I had to say. I told you a bit about what cosmic shear is and how it's connected to the matter-power spectrum. I told you about a model-independent parameterization that you can use to try and say what baryons are doing to the power spectrum. And it's a parameterization where you only need to capture a small, where you only need to keep a small number of the parameters you introduce in order to obtain most of the constraining power from a given set of observations. I talked about some forecasts we did where we tried to marginalize over the important systematics. And I showed you the results of our forecasts and that this technique will be useful potentially even for the dark energy survey year one measurements. And once these constraints are made, then they could in fact form a new universal test for all of these models or simulations for baryonic physics. So in addition to tuning to various properties of galaxy groups and black holes, in principle, they could also try and tune themselves to actual measurements of the matter-power spectrum to make sure that this aspect of the physics is realistically captured as well. And that's all. Thanks.
Standard model is fixed half-life memory of utility of gravity fluctuation. So in the late time calculation of the power spectrum, does general relativity ever have any effect? Not any of it.
You mean in the presence of baryons or in even, I would say that the all of these effects I showed for the effect of baryons are happening at scales small enough where these general relativity effects are basically in a different regime. So on very, very large scales, scales getting close to the size of the horizon, then you definitely do see effects, which will need to be taken into account for surveys with a very wide sky coverage. But in that regime, the effects of all these feedback and cooling processes are very negligible. So there's the two regimes, I would say, are decoupled. Yeah.
Another way, I guess, to explore baryonic effects is through the cross-correlation of galaxies, galaxy lens, and measure that.
Right.
And this is presumably something that's the halo shapes are being distorted by the baryonic effect.
Right.
So how does that method compare with this power spectrum approach?
I would say that this method is also, as you say, it's also super useful, and the most efficient thing would be to do a combined analysis between this with galaxy-galaxy lensing as well. I would say that the modeling of cosmic shear is slightly simpler because you don't need any properties of the foreground lenses, such as a model for galaxy bias or anything like that. Really, it's just the total matter, which is just based on the fluctuations from GR and then the matter-power spectrum that you measure. So in that respect, I think this technique has the slight edge, but definitely galaxy-galaxy lensing tells you a lot, and the combination will tell you more than this could on its own.
So the principal components seem to kind of sweep down power spectrum redshift, but the photometric redshifts are pretty uncertain for a lot of the source galaxies. So does that hurt in the sense that a single galaxy sort of sweeps across, like a lot of times sweeps across like a positive and a negative, like the low principal component, if there's a lot of uncertainty in redshift?
I think if you're doing tomography with these bins, with these redshift bins that are wide enough, I think you can mostly mitigate that because you're all of the uncertainties going into these N of Z curves for each bin. And if you can control that enough, then I think that should mitigate the effect that you're highlighting.
The population averages are
basically, yeah.